Hello and welcome to High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast with your host, me, Spencer, and some guy from Ventura or LA or something.
Whoa. Yeah, somewhere. Hi, I'm Joel. What? Yeah, I'm usually on these episodes.
Yeah, usually. So this episode is the second part of our 1962 pairing. We did Sanjuro with a special guest, Randall, the director, who is making a movie in the Philippines about monsters, if you remember that.
Yeah, I don't know if you are friends with him on Facebook, but he's been putting up all kinds of pictures. He looks like he's having fun.
Oh, yeah, I am. I plan to have him on for another movie, and I know exactly which one.
Oh, cool.
I haven't told him yet. But, yeah, so we just had Randall on talking about Sanjuro, and now we're talking about Hiroshi Teshigahara's Pitfall from 1962. Have you seen any other movies by Teshigahara?
Well, I think you already know the answer to that. You're the one who told us to watch The Face of Another.
That is true.
But I had actually seen it before because it was, you know, when I was unemployed, I used to sit at home and just, like, watch Criterion movies, and I was going through, like, alphabetically. And that, of course, F.A. comes up pretty early, so I'd seen it. And it was really weird. Face of Another is a very strange movie when you don't know what you're getting into.
And yeah, that's true.
After you're done, you're kind of like, that was really good.
But you never saw Pitfall or Woman in the Dunes?
No. Nope, none of that stuff. And then afterwards, we got to watch it again because you suggested it for our podcast, Please Don't Send Me into Outer Space. So were you on that episode?
Yes, I was.
So if you want to hear Spencer and I talk about that, just look up PDSMIOS and The Face of Another.
Yeah, it's a companion piece to this episode on Teshigahara's first film, Pitfall, which I think we can both agree it's not as good as Face of Another.
I would say that if I had seen Pitfall, I wouldn't have expected Face of Another. I don't think that this is nearly as strange, but it is. It does have the weird violence going on.
That is true.
It's not very complicated, which is one of the things I think that works against it, unfortunately. So here we go. We start off the movie with two miners, or yeah, these guys are at least two. Well, actually, does this movie actually start off with them?
I believe it. Where was it? No, it's the father and son, and they're leaving a house.
Right. There's the father and son are working for. Oh, okay, that's right. We're seeing like some weird sound effects going on there. It's a really surreal opening.
It's barking dogs.
And, like, other sounds, too. Like, there's just this noise, like they're in a haunted house or something. But it causes them to leave, and then we get the credits sequence.
And we see a shot of these, like, wild dogs on a hill that gets repeated, like, maybe four times in the whole movie.
Yeah. You know, they're the dog clan.
Yeah.
They're the ones who set the dog mood.
Alright, it's our turn to interrupt, but I'm going through Teshigahara's filmography.
Yeah.
He directed and shot like a short film called Jose Torres.
Yeah, I know that guy.
I just think it's funny that it's close to your name.
It is close to my name, but we're not related, okay?
All right.
Don't be racist.
All right, I'm just saying, because of connection.
So when we pick up with our friend Miner, who doesn't have a name, I believe, but that's on purpose. He doesn't have a name because he's just kind of inconsequential, like, accident that's waiting to happen. He's just like the means to an end.
Yeah, he's just a single father, and that's all you know.
Yeah, and he's got a boy who's like 7 or 8, or maybe like 6, but
seems more like 5 or 6 to me.
Young kid who's following him around everywhere, and he's got another buddy. And it turns out, we find out that they're actually deserters, I assume from the army. I don't know what else you would desert from.
I thought it was from a mining company that they're contracted to.
Yeah, I don't know. They don't actually go into it. They just say, you know, we might get caught because we're deserters. I hope they don't have pictures of us or whatever. And at first we see them working with a guy who is having them dig because he thinks there's going to be coal somewhere. But they leave the next day because they don't want to stay in one place for too long. They don't want to get arrested or whatever's going to happen to them.
Yeah, because they mentioned a bounty hunter. They might be bounty hunters looking for them.
Mm-hmm. And we see a person in white every once in a while. It's just a man in a very nice white suit with a hat. And it's sometimes just him driving by on this scooter, or sometimes he's standing in the distance looking. It's, you know, it's just something that you can't help but notice, because compared to our two minor friends who are obviously, you know, on the edge of starving, he's very well dressed.
Yeah, and he takes pictures on occasion.
Mm-hmm. And our friends, our two miner buddies and the kid, go to another town where they happen to be hiring miners, thank goodness. Sorry, hold on. Gonna burp. Okay. And they get hired on for the day. And this only lasts for one day when I assume this guy's the foreman. He comes up and to our main father, minor character guy, and says, "Hey, is this you?" And he's got a picture. And this feels like a trap. It 100% mm-hmm. feels like a trap. He already said he's like wanted for being a deserter. So why wouldn't you think, oh my gosh, I'm in trouble?
Yeah, that's a good point.
He says, "Hey, no, it's not a trap. Don't worry. This guy just wants to hire you. And he's like, here's a map to where he is. You just got to go over there." And his minor buddy's like, "Oh, man, that's good luck, man. You're lucky."
Yeah, it's another job.
Yeah. Yeah, everything's great. Why would you be suspicious? But so our miner packs up his stuff. He grabs his kid. They start walking.
Christopher walking.
Walking. And eventually they get to this ghost town. It's a completely abandoned village.
Ghost town.
Yes, quite literally. We'll get to that later.
Yeah.
But it's nobody's around. He's calling. He thinks he's in the right place of the map. Nobody's answering. And he just happens to stumble upon a shop. There is one person who is still in this town. And she is creepily picking up ants with her chopstick and drowning them one at a time.
And the ants are covering her food.
Mm-hmm. Covering her food and who knows where else, because she has a candy shop. She's the candy man, lady, girl, candy. The
candy man can?
Yes. Because it mixes it with ants. It makes the world taste like ants. And he's like, "Hey, I'm so glad I could come over here. I found a person. Do you know where this is?" And the woman who runs the candy shop is like, "Oh, yeah, I thought you were the mailman. I'm waiting for somebody to tell me where I need to go. This town closed down. It used to be a mining town, but the mine was declared too dangerous to work, so everybody just left." And she's weird. And even the miner is weirded out by her. So he's like, "Okay, I'm gonna go now. Thanks a lot." While this is going on, his kid is also trying to steal some candy, because you're a kid.
Yeah, some Mickey Mouse candy.
Yeah, steal some freaking candy, hell yeah. He doesn't get away with it, but the miner leaves a coin so that he can take the candy for his kid. He's a pretty good father, even though...
You know, yeah, he tries his best, given that they're vagrants.
Yeah. So he starts walking along in the direction that this lady at the candy store said he was going to be, or the spot he was looking for was. And we see our friend in the white suit again. And he is standing very obviously, like, in a group of weeds on the hillside, just looking at the miner. And the miner can't see him for some reason. I don't really understand how that works, but I guess it's just whatever.
It's something.
And the little kid has run off, who knows what he's doing, but the man in the white suit very carefully approaches the miner, and eventually it's not carefully anymore. The miner is kind of knows something is up.
And the guy takes out some white gloves, mm-hmm. and takes out a knife. Then the mm-hmm. miner realizes exactly what's going to happen.
Yep. And he runs down towards this area with it has water, right?
It's yeah, like, it's water. Yeah. It's like a muddy area.
Muddy area, and he gets stabbed quite violently to death. Just stabbed and stabbed and stabbed until he's no longer alive. And the man with the white suit walks away. The next thing we see is the miner, once again standing up, going like, what in the world is going on? And then we see that his dead body's on the ground. He says, am I dead? This establishes that we are ghosts. Well, he's a ghost, at least.
Yeah. And is this when he sees the other ghost of a dead miner?
You're talking about the one with the messed up, the head that's like he can't move it? It's not till later, but... It's
later.
Not too soon. Not too soon afterwards, and he... By the way, the lady who runs a candy shop has been staring at her window this whole time, so she saw our minor friend get murdered. And the man in the white suit, of course, sees her because she's not trying to hide the fact that she's looking at this until she thinks she might get caught. White suit walks up to the candy store and says, hey, I know what that looked like. This is what I need you to do. I'm going to give you all this money, and I need you, when the police eventually show up, to tell them that this person did it. He's, you know, this height. He looks kind of like this. He's got a bald patch above his right ear. You know, a very detailed account of who he says he wants her to tell the police murdered this minor. And she takes the money, because... I guess, well, why wouldn't you?
Yeah, she's in a ghost town.
There's
nothing there.
You're probably afraid this guy's going to kill her. Might as well take some of that sweet, sweet cash.
Oh, and we should note that she is waiting for a note from a man.
A man to tell her where to go, right?
It's like, I got the feeling of it's like an ex-lover or ex-husband, or maybe like a strange child.
Yeah. I'll tell you when to join me. Don't worry, I'll send a letter, I swear. So, this is, okay. So, we spend a lot of time with the ghost man, Miner. He's very upset. He wants to figure out why this happened to him, because we don't know why he was murdered. We don't know what's going on like that. He goes back to the mining town, and he sees a ton of people. A ton of people just walking around or like, miming, using tools.
Yeah. You know,
miming, hoeing into the ground, or chopping wood. And he tries to talk to them, but nobody will respond to him. Nobody seems to be able to see him, or at least acknowledge that he's there. And he goes to the candy shop and says, why didn't you do anything? Why didn't you, why did you take that guy's money? I mean, this is not cool, but she can't see him either. You know, she doesn't even know there's a ghost there. And eventually she gets to report to the shopkeeper reports to the police. And she tells him, the police, verbatim, exactly what the other person told her to say. And the ghost has been following her around the whole time because he wants to see what's going to happen, you know, how this murder is going to be solved. And now she's, now he's pissed at the shopkeeper for lying. He doesn't know. He didn't see the interaction between her and the man in a white suit, so no idea what's going on. By the way, the little boy, he's been running around all over the place. Did he see the murder? I think he did actually see the murder, too.
He sees every act of violence.
But he doesn't seem that beat up about it, which is kind of a thing that Japanese movies have for young males.
That is a thing I have noticed, too.
Yeah. I'm thinking specifically of a couple of ozu I've seen where there are, like, kids, like, the same age, and they just don't have reactions other than, I guess, they're kids.
I guess part of it is cultural of, like, repress your emotions, and part of it might be they're overwhelmed and they don't know how to process what they're watching or experiencing.
Yeah, that makes sense, yeah. That part does make sense. There was a part earlier where this kid just straight up murders a frog.
Like, yeah, he rips off the skin and...
Well, first he picks it up and he throws it, like, violently against the ground to kill it. And then, yeah, he starts, like, stripping off the skin. And it was a real frog. Like, this wasn't no fake frog.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, I don't care if you kill people in this movie. Don't kill a frog. What's wrong with you?
Yeah, it's not as bad as, like, Cannibal Holocaust.
No, of course not.
Or, like, Necromantic.
It's worse than in Friday the 13th, where they kill a real snake, but that's because you only see that for a second. It is still fucked up that they kill a real snake.
Oh, wait, in the original one?
Yeah, in Friday the 13th, there's, like, that part where there's, like, a snake in the cabin. Oh. They, like, you see it moving, they full-on cut it in half.
I assume that was fake, because Savini did the gore effects.
From what I heard, they used a real snake.
So
it's not cool. Anyway, this movie, whatever. He skinned that toad so that he can make a trap for a crustacean. And we do actually see, like, a lobster sort of thing trying to grab the frog off of this, you know, miniature fishing pole he made. But we go back to the scene of the crime. The police have come back with the candy store opener, and they are doing a very very good CSI.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't know back in the 60s they had this set up well enough to be able to do stuff like this, but they're putting down plates. They're like, make sure nobody's touched the body. Cast her into the footprints.
Well, that practice started in, I think, the 40s in England, and quickly spread because for that they had no, like, official procedure of, like, don't tamper with evidence, and it was a woman. I think she was, like, a vaguely royal woman who came up with it. Cause I remember stuff you missed in history class did an episode on her. Like, 4 years ago. People didn't take her seriously because they're like, what, you don't touch the evidence and you leave the crime scene as is? That's stupid.
It's a woman.
And then the British police were like, oh, actually, this works.
Yes. Oh, this man tried it and it worked. Say.
Yeah. So that practice was kind of still a new-ish thing.
Yeah, that's cool. It was cool to see. I don't think I've seen it on film represented earlier. You know, the closest to it would be like the, you know, 40s and 50s films where it's like a cop drama and the guys are taking pictures of the dead body. But I still feel like people are just stomping all over the evidence and stuff like that.
Yeah.
this one. They obviously showed a lot of care.
Yeah, this movie is very realistic in some ways.
Yeah. And so while this is going on, some reporters show up. And they're like, hey, what's going on here? You know, they're trying to take pictures. They're not allowed to take pictures. But they get a lot of... the cop who's up there tells them a lot of stuff. So it's not like they didn't get away with anything. But they take that story and they, like, run with it. They basically become the detectives at this point. Because they go back to their home office, wherever that is. And one of them is like, hey, I'm pretty sure that this guy who got killed is this foreman at a miner's operation, Otsuka?
He's a union leader.
Oh, union leader, yeah, Otsuka. Yeah, so let's see what's going on there, you know? Like, I bet they don't know he's been murdered yet. So they call him up, and they actually talk to Otsuka. So they're like, okay, well, that wasn't him. It's like, well, this is really weird, because this guy... looks just like him. So let's go to the site.
Yeah.
So the two reporters go to this this mining location to talk to the union rep. And they get the full story. Right now the unions have been split. There's a first union and a second union. There's actually two sites, the old mining site and the new mining site. A lot of details thrown in here.
Yeah, it's...
Not necessarily interesting, unfortunately.
No, it's relevant to... The movie is very of the time and what's criticizing.
Right. And we get... You know, they're like, oh, can we talk to Otsuka? And Otsuka comes out, and he's... he looks identical to the miner from the beginning of the movie. Now, side note, of course, he is actually played by the same actor. It's Asashi Egawa.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the ghost of the miner has been following these reporters around because he's like, well, these guys know what's going on. And when he sees Otsuka, he's like, what? How is this possible? Like, I don't understand. So the reporters are already like, so this is where it happened and it was around this time. And Otsuka's like, I was supposed to be in that area at that exact time, but somebody called and postponed it. So now we're thinking that Otsuka was the one who was supposed to get killed, and somebody sent that poor miner, who just happened to be his identical twin
or doppelganger.
His doppelganger, of course. He turned into some sort of weird alien skeleton guy
with flesh swords.
Yep. And a very, very long neck.
And they reformed the Drew Barrymore.
Yep. And she was cured. The end.
Yeah.
And no, so Otsuka thinks something is up. And the reporters have heard that the suspect is this guy with a bald spot. And Otsuka knows exactly who they're talking about. Who, it's another union leader, the one for union number one, apparently.
I think the Otsuka is part of groups that defected from their first union.
Yeah. So Otsuka gets on the phone to call union number one, Toyama. And they're on strike right now, so they're all just hanging out at the local bar or something like that. And he gets on the phone. He's like, what the hell are you talking about? I didn't try to get anyone killed. This is really weird. He's like, no, somebody tried to have me killed. They're saying that you're the number one suspect, so they're going to come arrest you. I'm just trying to let you know. It's like, wait, okay, we should go over there and try to get to the bottom of this together. So for some reason, Toyama and Otsuka think they need to go. So they start heading that direction. We go back to the shopkeeper who... is being protected by a police officer who decides, you know what? Somebody needs to rape this lady.
Well, yeah, but it quickly turns into she's okay with it.
Yeah, that's one of those unfortunate kind of like...
Yeah, it starts out as like...
this stereotypes.
It's a very rape scene, but it's like, oh no, she... also wants to have sex too.
Yeah.
It's weird.
I don't think it's a very comfortable portrayal, because
I think she's just so desperate for any attention she...
Yeah, but it's gross.
Yeah, I forgot about that part of the movie. Like, oh, I hope this doesn't go where I think it does. And yeah. It didn't.
And it's a really weird scene anyways, because I don't understand, because... okay, so we're not seeing them do it or anything like that. They're doing the typical... But the little
boy's watching.
Oh yeah, he's peeking through that crack in the wall there. This yeah, boy is getting his full education in 24 hours.
It's a little John Waters.
Mm-hmm.
But the shape of the hole in the wall he's watching through is the same shape of the wound that you see get a close-up of the dad.
Oh, crap.
Yeah, connections.
It all makes sense now. But, yeah, we flash back to the two gentlemen who are approaching this area where the murder took place. That's Toyama and Atsuka, the two union leaders. Toyama does this kind of cool thing where he's, like, riding on a train, but he gets off before the train is, like, near a station. He just kind of, like, jumps off and, like, runs alongside it, so... It's like, I want to do that.
Yeah, it's like he's a professional hobo.
I'll probably break my neck. Yep, and we, after that, we go back to the shopkeeper who is, we've just finished our lovemaking, I guess, around the police officer. When there's a knock at the door, the police officer goes and hides. Or does he just, he must straight up leave, right? He must,
like, go out the back way. I think the man in white walks in. And the police officer sees, and he's like, oh, not this guy. And he abandons the woman.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but... Yeah, I the knock at the door is the man in white. And he's here to finish what he started. So he kills the shopkeeper real quick.
And I think the boy watches that, too.
Yep. He's gonna see everything.
Yeah, I read a review where it says a boy sees every horrible act in the movie.
Yeah, he's a real bliss me ultima. That kid saw all kinds of terrible things in that book.
Yeah. Listen to Joel's episode of Sophomore Lit.
No, don't listen to that. It's terrible. Anyway.
It's good. It's right
I didn't,
before my episode.
I was like cringing. I didn't want to hear it.
It's good. It's right before my episode on Ambrose Bierce.
Listen to his episode on Ambrose Bierce. That's better. Yeah, so now she's a ghost. You know, now we got two ghosts. More ghosts possibly on the way. You were talking about that minor ghost earlier. There was an actual minor ghost that talked to our main character.
He was one of the minors that died.
He's like, they can't hear you. You're a ghost. And he says... Oh, did you eat before you died? Did you eat a big meal? And he's like, no. It's like, oh, that's too bad. Whatever state you were in when you died, that's how you are as a ghost. So you're gonna be hungry for the eternity.
And this
Anyways,
guy's gonna have
see
a,
you later.
And this guy's gonna have a crooked neck forever too.
Yeah. Rock must have fall right on his head.
Yeah, because his neck is permanently at an angle, like a clearly something snapped his neck.
Like yeah, his head is like resting on his left shoulder, basically, but he can't move it.
But that means he's always in pain?
My question is, did he have like a three-course meal right before? He's like, oh, did you eat? Because I totally did. Yeah,
I imagine if he's mining, probably had a good hearty breakfast.
That's true.
And lunch.
He ate that canary that they always take down there.
Yeah.
Or maybe he was trapped down there for a long time. He ate the other miners, and then a rock fell on his head.
That could have happened. The story doesn't really fill in that much detail.
And now we need a prequel to see what happened with this. Okay, no. So our two union officers, first, the Atsuka, who is the doppelganger of our miner, gets to the shop and sees that there is this dead woman there. And he's like, what the hell is going on? Like, there's just like straight up a murdered person here, and why are so many people dying in this area? Unfortunately, Toyama, the other union guy, happens to show up right then and peek into the hole and see him standing over this woman's dead body. So when Atsuka leaves the building, Toyama immediately is like, I saw you kill her.
Yeah.
Which is bullshit, man. You didn't see nothing.
I think he's just looking for an excuse to attack him.
Right. He's already suspicious. I mean, they're both suspicious. They want to know what's going on.
Yeah. They used to be union bros, and now they're not.
I feel like that's like something that happens in like the third grade or the fourth grade. And you're like, man, I saw you do that. No, you didn't. And then you fight. Because that's what happens.
Yeah, pretty much.
They start going at it like fucking dogs. You know, they are just fighting and punching each other and pushing each other, rustling down hills. Our dead miner friend goes and meets with the shopkeeper's ghost and says, hey, I see you're dead now too, so why did you lie? And she says, I thought that guy was going to kill me. He gave me money. I'm sorry. He's like, well, I guess it doesn't matter now.
Yeah, and then I think she says, then he killed me and took the money he gave me.
Yeah. Why did he kill me? You know, I wasn't going to say anything.
Well, he wanted to make sure.
Well, we don't know, okay? That's the thing. So our two union representatives are fighting and fighting. They end up getting into the water. And I forgot to mention that the man in white, after stabbing our first miner friend, threw his knife into the water to get rid of the evidence. Or at least to plant evidence for later.
Yeah, that's true.
But one of the union people finds the knife in the water and stabs the other guy. He then loses that knife, and Atsuka ends up drowning Toyama in the river. Atsuka gets up out of the water, is holding onto his knife wound, trying to walk forward. He sees the little boy again. The little boy who thinks that it's his father, because they look exactly the same. There's even a point where the kid saw him earlier and called him daddy. And then ran off when he realized it wasn't his dad.
Yeah.
And this Atsuka reaching for this kid falls over. He's dead.
Oh, and Atsuka falls in the chalk outline of his doppelganger.
Oh,
almost
man.
Exactly.
Yep. Knife wound. He's got way less knife wounds, though. He's only got the one. Must have got him right in the good place, though. Yeah, and then we see more ghosts. We see that Atsuka is now a ghost. We see that... Hold on a sec. There's a motorcycle driving by. We see that Atsuka is a ghost. We see that Toyama is a ghost. You know, they're now stuck in whatever way they were before. The miner talks about how hungry he is. And off in the distance, the shopkeeper and the miner see the man in white, who's looking through a pair of binoculars. He puts down the binoculars and he says to himself, that went exactly as planned.
Well, we should note that that the woman and the father are right in front of him, and he looks at both of them as he says that. Mm-hmm. And it's a weird sense of, can he see them?
And he starts walking, gets on his bike. The shopkeeper and the miner are going like, wait, why... Why did you do all this? Why did this happen? Where are you going? The man in the white suit gets on his bike and drives off.
Yeah, it's a really...
And they're screaming at him afterwards. Why are we dead?
Yeah, it's just a really creepy moment of, was he talking to them? Like that's a really great moment of this. It's great.
Yeah, that's it.
And the last
shot is we finally get to see this kid with emotion. Because he steals a bunch of candy, and he's very sad.
Yeah, I think he starts to cry.
Yes, there's tears running down his face. It is sad. I feel bad for him.
And then he just wanders off.
Yep. He runs, and we watch him run.
Yeah. Yeah.
There we go.
It's a very bleak movie.
Yeah. I feel like you can't even call this really a ghost story, because once these people were ghosts, they couldn't interact with anything. It's like they were just witnesses to what we were seeing in the movie.
Yeah, they're helpless to the events that were happening.
Yeah. I'd almost like to see like a cut of the movie where the ghosts are not in it.
I think it'd be less interesting.
Oh yeah, yeah. I think that's the thing. What is the message of the movie, in your opinion?
Based off what I've read, it's a critique of post-war Japan economy, and specifically how it treated the mining industry.
Mm-hmm.
And how, like, basically the 1% can do what they want, and if you're not the 1%, then you're basically a ghost, and you mean nothing to them.
Your actions and the consequences are inconsequential.
Yeah, you have no power.
Yeah.
You're basically a ghost that, you know, like in the movie, you're a ghost that is a state of being that can't change anything.
I almost feel like the ending of this movie was like also like a pre-reaction to how people might react to the way the movie ends. Where it's like, wait a minute, you're not going to answer the question? You're not going to tell us why this guy killed all these people? Yeah. It's like, yeah. Doesn't it feel like you're a ghost?
Yeah, it's like the man in white is a vague, like, corporate assassin who's trying to bust up the union so that the corporations have all the power.
Yep, he's a filmmaker.
Basically, the whole mining thing reminded me of my great-grandfather on my dad's side great-grandfather who started working in the mines when he was 11. Because his dad got injured, and this movie was for me weirdly personal because based off what my grandma's told me, like, the miners were treated not so great.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, them being deserters, I think it was probably like a mining town type of thing. Do you know what I'm talking about?
The situation where they owe money because of, like, the equipment that they've had to use
That, and my great-grandfather, he lived in a mining town, which was a small town owned by the mining corporation, where they have their own money, not American money, their own money that they pay the workers in, and they have a grocery store and general store, and prices are hiked up, and you owe them money, and they give you, you know, their version of money that is, of course, not equal to real money.
A dollar, yeah.
Yeah. And so this kind of reminded me of that and how the miners... Oh, and he died in the mid-50s, and right before the miners started to get some power, which is really unfortunate.
Yeah, I've worked in a mining town before.
Hmm.
Yeah, it was really weird. There was lily pads with frogs. There was a thing where you could knock over bottles. There was a thing where you hit a golf ball and tried to get it up a ramp. Oh, wait, that was Magic Mountain. Never mind.
Have you ever really been to Old Mine Town?
Yes, I have.
They're kind of weird.
Yeah, it's kind of creepy, but it is also fascinating.
Yeah, and I remember my grandma telling me they couldn't afford toilet paper, so they had to use phone books.
What else were you going to use a phone book for?
I don't know.
Nowadays?
But they had to use phone books or catalogs because, you know, the mining company didn't want you to afford fancy things like toilet paper.
I'd like to order the double-ply phone book, please.
Do you remember Sanjuro at all?
Yes, I do remember. Yes. Yes, I remember Sanjuro. Do you have any comparison to it?
Based off what I, well, my research, I couldn't really find much, really.
Yeah.
Aside from, in a lot of ways, it's a very opposite movie. This, like, where is it? Where, like, Sanjuro is just a pure popcorn flick.
Yeah.
And this is a very grim, realistic portrayal, and it's portrayal of, like, how minors are mistreated, slash fantasy ghost story, sort of.
Yeah, it feels, I mean, like, Yojimbo is a Western, right? That's what they say. Sanjuro feels even more like a Western to me in the fact that it's, like, so slight, so, like, you know, we're doing this because I'm a good person and thing and stuff like that. And you got, oh, the dumb characters. And this is not that kind of movie at all. This, if it has moments of humor, it's like maybe the way the ghosts are reacting and stuff like that. But it's pretty dour.
Yeah, like the shopkeeper woman. Not sure if you remember, but she's waiting for a letter and the letter finally arrives, but she's dead. And so she can never see what's in the letter.
Yeah, it was probably just like, you owe us money.
Yeah, so, but it was still heartbreaking because she can read the outside of it. It's from the man that she wanted a letter from, and then it's just like, she will be a ghost forever and never know.
Nah. This guy was in the guy who played the man in the white suit was in Sanjuro.
Ah, interesting.
He was also apparently in The Bad Sleep Well, but it doesn't look like he had a very big part.
I recognize his name.
Yeah, he has a pretty unique looking face from what I am used to.
Hmm.
So I recognized his face, but I couldn't really put it together.
I recognize his face, but I'd seen this movie before and remembered it.
Oh, I see.
Oh, there's a character in One Piece based off of him.
What? You mean the man in the white suit?
Yes.
Oh.
Okay. He's in Sword of Doom, too.
Okay. Well, who isn't?
But, my main comparison with between these two movies that is the same I found was death is treated very, very seriously.
Yeah.
Where in Sanjuro, it's about the basic thematic. The main thing is Sanjuro doesn't want to kill people anymore because that creepy old woman with the weird teeth tells him you shouldn't kill people anymore, and he's like, huh, you're kind of right. In this one, death is treated very grimly and seriously. And, like, the violence is very realistic and not glamorous at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, the violence isn't fun violence. It's like watching, what's that British movie? It's a British horror movie with, Michael Smiley in it. You know what I'm talking about?
I don't know what the hell you're talking about now. Is Michael Smiley an actor?
He's an actor and comedian. He's in Luther. He's in like the first two seasons. He was the drug dealer priest in what's the Simon Pegg Nick Frost movie about the bars
and the aliens? World's End. He was in Rogue One also.
Yes, and in World's End, he was a creepy priest—not creepy priest, but the drug dealer priest they bought weed from.
Okay. Let's see. A Field in England.
No, Kill List. That's it.
That's by the same guy. A Field in England. Ben Wheatley.
Yes.
Yeah.
Ben Wheatley produced a movie that we both like called The Greasy Strangler.
Never heard of it.
And he also produced. That was also produced by Elijah Wood.
Never heard of that one either.
Okay. Anyway, Michael Smut and Kill List is the violence is very grim and serious and realistic. Like there's a scene of the main character beating someone with a hammer, and you see like the dent in people in the guy's knee. It
Yeah, that sounds good.
it's a good movie. It's just hard to sit through. And Pitfall reminded me of that with the violence, where it's just unpleasant to watch.
Yeah. Everything happens so fast in Sanjuro when it comes to violence. It's not comparable, you know?
Yeah. But I also, I don't know if this makes sense, but I feel like in Sanjuro, death is talked about through the killers of Sanjuro and the Nakadai character. And in Pitfall, death is talked about through the victims, because we see the ghost talking about like the effects of death, where in Sanjuro and the rival samurai are talking about like the effects of killing people.
Sure.
Do you get, does that make sense?
No, it makes sense. I don't think they have much in common.
Yeah, that's like kind of, and like you mentioned the violence, and Sanjuro is very cinematic and more like fun. Did you like it though? Would you recommend
I
it?
liked it fine. I wouldn't like if The Face of Another is a strong recommend.
Yeah.
This movie is like, it's okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's his first movie, so.
Yeah, it's fine. Like, I don't. I wouldn't say race out there and watch it. Hold on a second.
Okay.
Okay, I'm back.
All right. Yeah, I would recommend it because Tetsuya Gohara only made like six movies in like a 35-year career, and this isn't that many movies of his that you can watch.
Right, but there's all kinds of other Japanese movies you can watch.
That's
Or other
true.
movies from 1962 that we're going to talk about.
Yeah, but like his first, but Tetsuya's first three movies that he made with the same composer and same writer.
Yeah, writer.
Yeah, who was a playwright too. They collaborated on Pitfall, Woman in Dunes, and Face of Another, and those are very strong, interesting movies that should be seen. But after that, he kind of made one movie in 68 called The Man Without a Map. He directed some TV episodes of Zatoichi, and he directed a movie called Antonio Gotti. Goaty in 84, and two more movies in 89 and 92, and
Jose Torres.
that's from 1959.
Oh.
I think that's like a short film or something.
You could have fooled me.
Yeah, so like there's not that many movies from Tetsuya Gohara, and I think he's gravely underappreciated as a director. Do you have opinions on Tetsuya Gohara as a director?
No, I've only seen those two movies, so I'd say he's a 50-50 person right now.
Okay.
A Face of Another is really great. That's I just keep going back to that.
You should see Woman in Dunes. It's not like the other two movies.
Yeah, I'll definitely check it out.
It's the slowest paced one, though. It's not that a bad thing, but it's definitely slower paced compared to the others. All right, so other 62 movies, I got two.
62 other movies? Jeez.
1962.
Oh, okay. You go first. What's your first one you want to talk about?
All right, I just have two. One is I always get the name wrong. Tarkovsky.
Yes, Tarkovsky, right?
Okay, Ivan's Childhood from 1962. It's, I believe, based off a book, and it's a movie about a 12-year-old. Where is it? it's been a while since I've seen it. He's a 12-year-old Russian boy who is I believe, a scout or a spy for the Russians in World War II, and it's just his time during World War II. And of course, it's not that uplifting, given it's about basically a Russian boy who was like a POW in a German camp. And it's better than Stalker because it's coherent, and it's my second favorite World War II movie, right behind Closely Watched Trains, which is a World War II movie also about a teenage boy in a Nazi-occupied Europe. But Ivan's Childhood is really good. It's a good 97 minutes. I recommend it if you want to see a good Russian World War II movie that's not like about like the heroism of the Allies. It's just like the story of this one person. And there's no like political, no like overtly like patriotic overtones to it.
That sounds terrible.
You'd like a more Stalker. It's understandable.
I like Stalker. I just don't understand it.
Okay. I like Stalker too, but Ivan's Childhood is the better movie.
I like Solaris too. I don't really understand that one. But it's more understandable than Stalker.
You should watch Ivan's Childhood.
That sounds terrible.
Really?
I'm just kidding. It's fine.
Okay.
Want me to name one?
Yeah, your turn.
Oh, fine. Okay. Well, geez. So, let's see. I would have to say that. Oops. I would have to say that I just pressed a button, so there goes my movies. So one of the movies I'm going to mention is Cleo from 5 to 7, which is a Agnes Varda movie from
Oh,
62, obviously.
FilmSpotting's doing an Agnes Varda thing.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yes, they are.
And this movie follows around a woman who is a singer, and it is literally like the film is taking place of like it'll show little titles of this minute to that minute from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. in her life, and it's just kind of really light and enjoyable. It's not like a comedy, but
Is it funny? Like, is it like
it
funny
has
in a Coen
funny.
Brothers kind of way, where it's just
No,
kind of.
no, 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 no. No.
Okay.
It's funny in a like frivolous kind of way.
All right.
Like it's not really a comedy. I don't know how to. I don't know what I'm talking about, all right? You finally figured it out.
Is it funny in the way that,
It's just really it's really well shot,
okay.
and I seeing her moment to moment like emotional spectrum that this woman has to go through because of the life she's living and the people she has to deal with and stuff like that. And there's a scene where she has an entire room full of kittens, which is adorable.
That
It's
sounds good.
really well done.
Is it funny in the way that your next is funny in the, like the situations? Because I think
No.
your next is a hilarious movie that is
No,
like
no,
not,
no.
but it's not jokey. It's just kind of like situations happen to be well written and stuff.
No, damn it.
Okay.
It's funny like a 1960s French movie.
Is it New Wave?
It's new wave-esque. I don't know if it actually is new wave.
Okay. On FilmSpotting, they were saying that Agnes Varda was doing like French New Wave in the 50s before Godard. And who's that other big one?
Truffaut.
Yeah, it's like before those guys were doing French New Wave. She pioneered a lot of French New Wave stuff.
Well, I've only seen three of her movies, and they were all pretty different. She seems like she picks things and tries to do them in ways that are not similar to the way that she did the last movie.
She's still alive, too.
She is dead. She died today.
Really?
I may have made that up.
Okay.
One, two, three, four.
I think she's still alive. All right.
She is, probably.
Right. Yeah, like she made a movie in 2010, 2011. Like she's still making movies on occasion. All right, my second pick is David and Lisa. It's a very well done drama written by Eleanor Perry and directed by her husband Frank Perry, and they have a famous niece named Katy Perry. And
who?
Katy Perry, the pop singer.
No.
Yeah, Frank Perry, the director, is her uncle.
Wow.
Yeah, she's a Hollywood connection. And so David and Lisa is a movie about, I believe it's based off a book about these two teens and a mental health school, in a school basically for children with mental illness that need special education. And these two teens named David and Lisa who really find a connection, and they, it's basically like a love story, but it's not like a love story in a way that you would, it's done typically. And there's no like, oh, love solves their mental illness. Like the movie ends on a note of they both kind of have a breakthrough, but it's a very, but you can tell it's very, takes a lot for them to really push through the mental barrier to like try to not be normal, but to push through their mental illness and like be able to, you know, like function. And it's a very sweet movie. And Lisa, her thing is she has a second personality named Muriel who speaks in rhymes. And David is, I think it's OCD. Like he's afraid, he doesn't touch anyone because he's afraid he'll get their germs and die. And certain multiple parts where people like try to hold his hand, like try to touch his hand, and he like flips out on him. And it's a very well done movie. It treats mental illness and portrays it in an accurate, respectful way. Frank Perry was nominated for Best Director and lost, and Eleanor Perry was nominated for Best Screenplay and she lost.
Katy Perry's in it?
She wasn't born yet. But
what's the point of watching it?
Well, for you, the actor who played David, he's in 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Did he play David in 2001 A Space Odyssey?
I think he did play David.
So it's now I'm drawing a blank on his name.
It's Keir something.
Yeah, Keir Doyle.
Yes, that guy.
D'Elia.
Yeah, D'Elia. He plays David.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
What about the guy who played Frank Poole?
Who?
You don't, man. I can't even help you.
Okay. You should see it if you want to see more of the guy who played Dave in 2001.
Yeah. And Katy Perry's origins.
It's her aunt and uncle. Frank is dead. He died in 95, I think.
Wow. That's terrible.
Yeah.
I should really write her an email or something.
I think she's doing just fine.
(sighs) So my other movie from 62 is La Jetée, which is a science fiction movie, question mark? I mean, what it is basically...
I consider it science fiction.
Well, I know it's science fiction, but whether or not it's a movie...
It's a series of moving pictures, so yes.
Well, it's not a series of moving pictures.
Well...
It's a series of still images. It's like a slideshow.
It counts. It's an experimental film.
Although there is one part where it is like an actual motion picture. But it's a very small scene. Yeah, it's 30 minutes long, super quick. The movie 12 Monkeys is loosely based off of it. Or not so loosely, depending on how much you want to buy into it. And I just saw it for the first time last year. And it just, like, absolutely blew me away. It sounds like the kind of experience that somebody would be like, oh, if you're into movies, you gotta check this out, like art movies or something like that. But it is so, what is the word I'm looking for? It sucks you in, like, and those 28 minutes, like, rush by. And the way it's narrated, it's all narrated in English. Even though I think it's, or isn't?
If I remember correctly, I thought it was subtitles.
Subtitles.
I thought it was in French.
Okay, I'm thinking because the director is an American. But the movie's, yeah, that's right. It's French with subtitles. But it takes you on this journey just through these, like the narration, through the photographs, and you fill in what's in between. And it's done, like, creatively in a way that I have not seen before. Like, I can't recommend La Jetée enough.
I have seen it, too. I really like it as well.
But it doesn't have anyone for 2001 in it.
That is true. Oh, I found another movie to recommend. I haven't seen it. But it's written by Rod Serling. It's called Requiem for a Heavyweight. It's a boxing movie, and Serling was a big fan of boxing. There's a Twilight Zone.
We haven't seen this movie.
No, but it's Rod Serling, so I have to recommend it. I love Rod Serling.
It could be terrible.
No, it's probably just good because he was just a good writer, not a great writer.
Why don't you recommend the first Zatoichi movie?
No.
Come on.
But Requiem for Heavyweight is something I've heard of for a while that I didn't know. I knew Serling was behind it, but I never actually seen it. But I didn't know it came out in 62, so I gotta recommend that. Oh, and his buddy Jackie Gleason is in it, too.
But that first Zatoichi movie's pretty good.
Yeah.
Come on!
Oh, the first one? I've seen two of the later ones. I forgot which ones. And they felt like the same one. Tale. No.
Oh, they are pretty much all the same, but... it's not the point, okay? Okay.
But, Serling... Nakadai in it. Okay, then I should see it.
I'm just kidding, it doesn't have Nakadai in it.
Never mind. But Serling loved boxing so much, there are a couple boxing Twilight Zone episodes. One of them, called Steel, which is the inspiration behind the movie Real Steel, starring Hugh Jackman.
Steel with Shaquille O'Neal.
No, the Hugh Jackman Rock and Sock and Robots movie is based off a Twilight Zone episode.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Never mind.
It is.
That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah. The Twilight Zone is much better. But all right, so the next pairing of episodes, we're going back in time to 1950, when Harry S. Truman was still president. Not the sheriff. Harry Truman, the present Harry Truman, the one who dropped the A-bomb. Never mind, I can't remember. Anyway,
yes, you're correct.
In 1950, we got a little movie called Rosho. Actually, Kurosawa had two movies in 1950. We're doing the one that isn't Rashomon. We're doing Scandal, which is a legal drama about basically a TMZ group of group of reporters are getting sued by a celebrity.
Scandal.
I think it's very underrated, and hopefully we'll have a guest on that one. Got schedule stuff. And the other movie will be Wedding Ring with Toshiro Mifune, 1950, which I think Kurosawa may have written it. I can't remember.
Akira Kurosawa, Scandal, and Wedding Ring.
Sometimes it's called Engagement Ring, but I think that's a translation thing.
It is on Filmstruck.
Yeah, that's why I picked it.
Sure it is.
And we might have a special guest for that one. Just got to schedule stuff around.
Let's see. Wedding Ring, you're saying that you thought it was directed, or it was written by Akira Kurosawa?
I think it was written by him.
According to Letterboxd.
I know he wrote some other movies that other people directed. I just don't remember which ones.
Kagemusha? Oh, wait, that was him.
No, he directed that. Yeah, anyway. He didn't write it. It's another movie I'm thinking of with Mifune.
Tora, Tora, Tora?
He directed part of it, but he left mid-production. He may have written that. He's supposed to, not sure if you saw this, but his last movie was supposed to be, after Matadayo, was going to be an adaptation of The Mask of the Red Death. Set in early 1900s Russia, but he kind of, his health declined, and he was not able to make it.
Man, he directed way too many movies.
Yeah.
I'm trying to find another one that, okay, Snow Trail from 1947.
He wrote that?
Yes.
Okay.
Also had Toshiro Mifune in it.
Oh.
Interesting. Yeah. I'm going to add that to my watch list. Anyway,
yeah.
If you want to hear more of us, you can listen to the episodes of Please Don't Send Me Outer Space that Spencer's on.
Yeah.
Of course, we have a full back catalog. We've already covered how many Kurosawa movies at this point?
On this podcast?
Yes.
Four.
Four Kurosawa and another four additional other Japanese movies. We've had some great guests on. Check those out. They're all on SoundCloud, or if you go to Facebook, you can find the Facebook page for this site.
Yeah. We have some great guests coming up.
We better.
Yeah. There's one special guest who might be coming up. I'm still in the process of.
And if you want to hear random science fiction and fantasy movies, I have a podcast called Please Don't Send Me Into Outer Space. That's on SoundCloud, Facebook. You can find us look up for basically any popular science fiction movie, you're going to find an episode. That's not true.
Not bad.
We cover all kinds of different stuff, though. We've covered Jurassic Park, Beetlejuice, that kind of stuff, but also things like Repo Man, which is really great, Wild Zero.
Hawk the Slayer,
Kroll.
Nick Kroll?
Yep, Nick Kroll the movie. He went to space. And, of course, Sun Ra is the space is the place.
Yeah.
New episodes every week from that. What about you? You got other stuff?
Write for Summon Knife Fight, old TV reviews, science fiction, fantasy, horror. If there's weird science or magic, then I'm going to review it. This month's, I don't know. Anyway, for March, I'm reviewing this sitcom from the early 80s called Kinvig, where this guy works at a repair shop for electronics and he gets abducted by aliens, but no one believes that he was abducted by aliens. And when aliens takes the form of an Earth woman and lives in his neighbor. It's not very good, but I'm reviewing it.
Somebody's got to do it.
Yeah. So, that's coming up. And I'm going to review coming up Hammer, House of Horror. Hammer Studios had a TV show briefly. And that's coming up. And I'll get to the Outer Limits eventually. I keep telling myself, I'll do it now with him. I'm like, nah, I can push that back later.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's that. And, oh yeah, Joel and I have both been on Sophomore Lit. It's a good podcast if you want to hear about literature discussion and or books you had to read in high school. Joel had a good one on Bless Me Ultima. I never heard of that until his episode. And I did mine on Ambrose Bierce, who I share a birthday with. And, yeah.
You guys were born the same year?
Same day.
Oh.
It's the same birth, and Mindy Kaling has the same birthday, too.
Oh, why didn't you do her book?
It's not literature.
What? Wow.
And,
judgy much?
And RoboCop, I have the same birthday as, too.
Buckaroo Banzai. RoboCop came online the same day you were born. That is crazy.
We have the same day, me and RoboCop. Weller. That's it.
Oh, Peter Weller. Okay.
Yes. June 24th.
I love that guy.
Yeah. I'm in good company. And Robert Downey Sr. too.
Yeah, we should do a podcast with his movies.
Did he make a lot of movies?
He made several.
Oh. I've never seen him.
Oh, man. You got some homework.
Okay. So, that's it for this episode. Next episode will be Scandal with hopeful guest Josh Hollis from Predictocast.
If we can get him.
Yeah. He's until busy then, in Hollywood.
Until then, hashtag thug life. Oh, wait. That's what you say.
What? Well, I had a new one anyways.
Okay, what is it?
Hootie Tootie Disco Cutie.
No.
Afita Zane, hashtag thug life.
Take me disco dancing, Big Ronnie. Don't you worry.